What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
What's up, guys? Red Nation Hoops Podcast. My name is Soman Ali at Red Nation Hoops on Twitter. You're joined by Forrest Walker at Do Nots on Twitter. How you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good.
Also joined by the man of the hour, the guy we're here to talk about, George Flores at George Flores 2022. How you doing, man?
I'm pretty good, man. What's up?
So the reason I brought us all together is because we're here to talk about Executive of the Year, and we're here to talk about specifically Daryl Morey's case for it. Now, George, you wrote a column about it earlier this week, laying out basically Daryl Morey's case for this, and I have a lot of thoughts on this. And this might be a hot take. I think Daryl Morey specifically, I think he has a better case for his award than anybody else on the Rockets for their award. I'm not sure if that's a hot take to you guys. I think the reason I say that is because every award the Rockets win this year, right? If, let's just say, James Harden wins MVP. Well, who traded for James Harden 5 years ago? Daryl Morey.
Right.
If Mike D'Antoni wins Coach of the Year, well, who hired Mike D'Antoni? Daryl Morey. If Eric Gordon wins Sixth Man of the Year, well, who signed Eric Gordon this summer? Daryl Morey. Etc. You can keep on going down the line. Whatever award the Rockets win, every piece of hardware the Rockets win only favors Daryl Morey. And the Rockets are on pace to win like 15 more games this year than they did last year. And that's basically just based off of one summer of improvement and off-season additions. And I just think, like, strictly case. I'm not talking about likelihood. Like, I think he has the best case to win this award.
I don't disagree with that. I mean, I think... But now that I think about the other awards, I think James Harden has a really good case. I think everyone has a really good case, but I think you're right when it comes to Daryl Morey about just based on how this award is usually handed out, I think he does have the best case.
Yeah, he's fighting a similar battle, though, to the battle that Harden's fighting against Westbrook in that he's got an opponent who's making a pretty strong case based on one singular thing, right? Westbrook has a triple-double, and then Bob Myers has Kevin Durant.
Yeah. I also think like there's some other candidates for this award. So let's lay out the field real quick. So Bob Myers obviously is a candidate. If he signed Kevin Durant this year, that gets you in the conversation like automatically. I think two other candidates that other people aren't talking about as much, David Griffin of the Cleveland Cavaliers, the moves he's been able to make around LeBron without giving up too much, like, you know, trading for Kyle Korver and waiting till the trade deadline and the buyout market to clear up so he can sign Deron Williams. And he signed Andrew Bogut there for a second, even though he's not on the team anymore. Those were moves he made with limited resources, and I think that gives him a case, and I think Dennis Lindsay, what he's been able to do with the Utah Jazz over the years, just drafting smart, like Rudy Gobert late in the draft, Gordon Hayward, trading for George Hill this summer. That was huge. That basically was the singular reason that they're doing this well this season. The biggest reason for their improvement is because of the George Hill trade, and I think other executives are going to take into account for that. And yeah, the difference between this award and other awards and why I think this might hurt Daryl Morey is this isn't voted on by the media. This is voted on by other executives, and other executives don't like Daryl Morey.
Sure don't.
Yeah, I'm sure they're sick of their phones ringing every trade deadline, just seeing Daryl Morey's number pop up. It's got to be pretty frustrating.
I mean, they know that, for example, Danny Ainge is going to try to fleece them, but they know that Daryl Morey will fleece them.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically the calling card. Like, Daryl Morey will blow up your phone 3 times a day for a trade he might not even make, right? That's basically what, like, the book on Daryl Morey. And other executives know that, and that's why he's never been able to win any of these awards, even though I think he's had a pretty good case a couple summers ago when after the James Harden trade and after he signed Dwight Howard. I thought that was his best case up until this season for executive of the year, and he was like fifth in that race or something like that. Like, he just doesn't get enough votes.
Yeah, it wasn't I can't remember what the numbers were, but it wasn't like close. Yeah. Like, he got just a couple of votes and no first place votes or something. It was just like a couple of third place votes, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, he just doesn't get the respect from his peers, and a lot of this is because he makes quote unquote the obvious move, right? And like he'll make a move, and like 3 months later, it feels like it's obvious, right? Like getting Ryan Anderson and Eric Gordon to surround James Harden, like getting shooters around James Harden. Like, at the time, that was a ridiculed move, right? But now it seems like of course, surround James Harden with shooters. Like, that's all anybody could. I could have done that, right? Like, that. Yeah. I feel like that hurts him a lot. And like signing Dwight, of course, Dwight Howard is one of the 3 best centers in the NBA. Why would I not sign Dwight Howard? Like, that doesn't make him a genius, right? Like, I feel like also the James Harden trade, right? Like, there's a lot of revisionist history with Daryl Morey, and I just think that hurts him a lot for this award. And the fact that he's not like a former player, he's not a former coach, he's not somebody who's been in the NBA before. He's from the MIT branch of things, and like, I feel like that hurts him. Like, what do you guys think of that?
Oh, I think that you're right, and he's a really uphill case for getting executive of the year. Like, I just think that he's not going to get it now or any time. I think it's not going to happen for him. Because, like you said, it's like 29 dudes vote on this. So when you're in an uphill battle, you're in an uphill battle. So it's fine. He doesn't need executive of the year. He needs to get some other hardware instead.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, as far as like the other executives not liking him and like, or not, probably not going to vote for him, I can definitely see that. I just, I don't know. It's just this award in general is just so weird in the way it's been handed out and like the type of teams, the type of executives that get rewarded. It's just, it's been like, real quick, I just want to bring up two examples. Like last year, the Spurs won, RC Buford won. And basically his main move was bringing the band back together and signing LaMarcus Aldridge, the biggest name in free agency. So, like and they won 67 games. So it's clear that he was deserving. But then if you look back to the 2013-2014 Spurs, RC Buford won, and like he did almost nothing in terms of transactions and roster moves. But they won 62 games. So it's just kind of weird how this award works. And then actually going back all the way to 2009, his name escapes me, but the GM of the Nuggets at the time won the award, and he did not do that well in terms of roster moves, and they won 54 games. So it's just a weird thing. It's a weird, like, there's no defined thing. Like, there's no, just how they don't define most valuable player, it's this thing. This award is also, I think, the least defined of the kind of major awards.
Yeah, and you make a great point about comparing it to the most valuable player award, because the name is really deceptive, right? Because you can't be a good executive in 1 year, right? Like, you can't just have like a great season of being executive unless you're going crazy hard at like in the off season and the trade deadline. Like, generally, like making a great compelling franchise is built up through the years, and the way these awards are handed out, it is kind of random, because it is like kind of like, okay, we haven't given this guy enough love for what he's done with this team in a while. Let's go ahead and give it to him now. Like, I feel like that's the way it's done. Like RC Buford, obviously great general manager. Like, he wins 67. Oh, he's relevant now, right? Because the Spurs are like this, like one of the greatest regular season teams in NBA history, and it feels like a good time to reward him for consistently being a competent organization, right? Like, I feel like that's just the way it's very, very random. It's like wherever the executives are leading one way, that's generally where they're going to go with the award. And Yeah, it's very, very vague in the way they define the award too, because again, this is something you can't win in 1 year. You can't like if you like for MVP, I feel like a superstar, like if he wants to, can go all out for an award for 1 year, right? Like if he really wants to be, like let's just say Eric Gordon really wants to be Sixth Man of the Year, like he can work on doing that, right? You can't really do that if you're an executive, right? And and that complicates things, and that's why they probably need to change how frequently the award is handed out. Like I feel like it should be like executive of the decade or executive of the last 5 years, like or something like that, or they need to rebrand it or something. Like it's a very weird award. But let's go ahead and make his case. Let's go ahead and make Daryl Morey's case for him, and hopefully some executive is listening to this and we can get some votes here. Let's start with this offseason, right? Because that's really where we need to start with how Daryl Morey has reshaped everything for the Rockets. So going into this offseason, the Rockets won 41 games last season, and some major changes needed to be made. And it's not even just like in one particular area. Across the board, you fired Kevin McHale. You have an interim coach laying in the wind right now. Your roster isn't that good. Like in retrospect, like Corey Brewer is not a very good basketball player. And now you realize that, and now you have to kind of rebuild, like and find new guys and find pieces that support James Harden. And it's very difficult, right? Like it's like the first, like I felt like the first step that Daryl Morey needed to make, and I was tweeting about this, and like we wrote columns about this during the summer. Like I felt like the first important move was getting the coach hiring right, and like I was writing a column about this summer. I think I said something like, the coach you hire right now, like you have to keep this in mind. Like this has to be James Harden's last coach. Right, you have that's the mindset you have to go into these meetings with. Like this is gonna be James Harden's Rick Carlisle or his Greg Popovich. Like that's the kind of mindset you need to have going into these meetings. And you know, Daryl Morey goes out and hires Mike D'Antoni, and it's met with a lot of backlash. And here we are, like 6 months later, and James Harden's calling him like his best friend in interviews, unprompted, and it couldn't have worked out any better.
Yeah, and it speaks to what was necessary in terms of like a culture change that the Rockets desperately needed from last year. And I mean, even just to go right before hiring D'Antoni, the Rockets, they had to say all the right things, but they knew like, okay, we have to move on from Dwight. But moving on from a perennial All-Star is not like in theory something you should do. but if it's that much of a canter, I guess, on the team, that it was the first step in this culture change, and I think D'Antoni just kind of solidified that step, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and it's amazing that they got it right, to be honest. Like everybody was disappointed by the hiring of D'Antoni, given his
absolutely
honestly, pretty grim track record. Yeah, like same with Ryan Anderson. I mean, these are moves that did not look fantastic at the outset. I mean, that's a lot of money for Ryan Anderson, and it's still on the table that maybe in later years that contract doesn't look so good. But right now, everything looks like the perfect move. You know, that looks like you said the culture's been rebuilt. They were able to move on, not only lose an All-Star, but gain like 15 wins.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's crazy how that happens, right? Like you lose an All-Star. I mean, you make the decision to let go of Dwight Howard, and you make the decision to hire Mike D'Antoni, and immediately there's ripple effects, right? Like the as soon as you hired Mike D'Antoni, like the offseason was set. Like the mindset going in is you need to surround Mike D'Antoni with the requisite talent that supports his style of play, right? And that's where we get to Ryan Anderson and Eric Gordon. And when these signings were made, I can tell you, man, like even myself, like I'm not innocent in all this. Like I ripped the Ryan Anderson signing. Like I thought it was terrible. Like $80 million over 4 years just seemed like a lot of money for somebody who was injury riddled for the most part. And you know, like just unproven, and it felt like the narrative on Ryan Anderson was quickly shifting to is he playable on a championship team? Is he playable on even a playoff team? Right, like, because his defense is so bad. Like, can you justify putting him on the court in key moments? Right, and that was becoming the narrative of his career. And same with Eric Gordon. Like, Eric Gordon, the narrative was quickly becoming like, he's really freaking good, but like, the dude can't play. Right, the dude plays like 40 games a year. Like, is it really worth signing somebody if you're not sure if he's going to be on the court? And like, I thought, like, looking back at it, these were kind of smart moves, like, because like, these were guys who weren't really highly sought after, right? Like, the best teams weren't really going after these guys. Like it was pretty these were inefficiencies in the marketplace. These guys were damaged goods that Morey essentially rebuilt.
Yeah, and amazing kudos to them for apparently correctly recognizing that the training staff in New Orleans, either recognizing the training staff in New Orleans was bad, or that those were fluky injuries, probably both. Because everyone seemed to think that neither of them could stay healthy, and if they could, their defense was bad. Neither of their defenses have been anywhere near as bad as advertised, and they've also... I say as Ryan Anderson currently has a twisted ankle, but they've been way better at staying healthy this year, probably because Houston has a better training staff than using the local football team staff. But yeah, that's been super impressive that these guys worked out so much better than anyone expected.
Yeah, and I mean, just looking at Eric Gordon's contract, 4 years, $53 million. How is that not like the steal of the century? That's just a phenomenal contract. At the time, at the time of the signing, we all thought like, "Oh, that's a risk," but that's a calculated risk. But it just looks like a total steal now.
And compared to the contract the Rockets are about to give out to Kent Bazemore, I mean, like, the Rockets are about to offer Kent Bazemore like a 4-year max, right? And like, thank God. Like, looking back at like, Kent Bazemore might be trash. Like, that might like that might not have been a smart move, and the Rockets might be in a crappy situation right now if they had made that signing, right? And like, I mean, like, if you look in retrospect at the bullets they dodged to get here, I mean, how different would this team be if they had Kent Bazemore and like Al Horford? Like, would they still be a 56-win team? I'm not sure, right?
Ooh, I mean, that's a tough hypothetical, but you can't really imagine it going much better than this. Like, this really does seem like it's probably about as good as anything could have gone. I don't know, maybe Bazemore would have been better in Houston, but he certainly has looked totally bad. He's looked awful this year.
Well, he is playing next to a certain perennial all-star that the Rockets got rid of, so that could factor in.
Hey, can we talk about that for a minute, by the way? That, like, that perennial all-star has been doing the things he always does. And I want to say I bear no ill will to a certain nameless all-star. His name is Dwight. But I don't have any ill will to him, but that he's kind of doing exactly what Houston fans said he would do, that he's done everywhere, where he requires post touches and operates in a way which is not conducive. Like, I don't know why they picked him up. It's kind of surprising that anybody thought that like Dwight leaving was not going to, if anything, help the team.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to what Solomon said earlier about revisionist history with Morey's moves. Looking at it, it's like, yeah, well, of course losing Dwight was going to make us better, but I think Rockets fans knew that deep down inside, but I feel for Atlanta fans right now.
I mean,
that season is going so weird.
I mean, even if you think back to the trade deadline, right? Like, everybody, I felt like the Rockets fans were like a sick dog at last year's trade deadline, right? And they wanted to be put out of their misery, right? Like, they wanted somebody to shoot them in the head, like, and like, so badly. And that bullet was Dwight Howard, right? Like, everybody wanted him to be gone. And like, ironically, like they were right. Like losing Dwight Howard was such like. It was like I can't even describe the amount of burden the Rockets have like lifted off the show. Not to say, and I hate how we have to qualify this every single time we mention Dwight's name. Like Dwight was a good guy for the community. He was a very good player for the 3 years he was here. He was very good. You know, he had some great performances, but man, like, it got really ugly, like, back, like, and just, like, the Rockets did not want to play the way Dwight Howard wanted to play, and Mike D'Antoni certainly did not want to play the way Dwight Howard wanted to play. And
that's for sure.
Yeah, and we've seen this before, right? And, it feels like the biggest addition by subtraction move in, like, the past 5 years, like, that I could think of off the top of my head in the NBA.
Yeah, and it's pretty wild to hear all the accounts after the fact of how much these guys just didn't get along, but neither of them were the kind of dude who would, you know, make a full-on confrontation, so it just kind of stewed and festered. I mean, that kind of fits in with what we were saying at the time. Not to digress too much, but Lessie's and a lot of us were saying, oh, it just looks like they all hate each other now, and, well, they did, so it's kudos for the executives, Daryl Morey, et cetera, for being bold enough to just say, you know what, we got to part ways with this potential Hall of Famer because it's destroying the career of the other one.
And in almost a certain way, like, it almost would have been better if they would have thrown blows, right? Like, like that festering tension of that non-confrontational way, like, that they operate, like, that almost contributed to, like, how bad the locker room got. The fact that they didn't confront each other, like, it would have been better if they got into a full-on fight, right? Like, in some ways, right? Like, at least, like, you would have got your differences aside, and, like, it feels like, just by letting him go and that awkwardness going away, the Rockets added, like, 5 wins, and letting Clint Capela take that starting spot, which I feel like is another reason, like, Daryl Morey should be a shoo-in for this award. Like he had the foresight to, one, draft Clint Capela as late as he did in the draft, and two, like, recognize that, okay, I think he's ready for the starting position. I think he'll do really well with James Harden in the pick and roll. And it's worked out beautifully, right? Like, Clint Capela has been awesome, especially post-All-Star break. And, like, that pairing with him and James Harden couldn't have worked out any better.
Yeah, in large part because Clint Capela actually wants to do the things that he needs to be doing. That's a huge deal.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if we wouldn't be having this problem if Dwight Howard just, you know, set some screens and ran for the lobs, you know, instead of calling for post-ups. But yeah, I mean, just to see that Morey saw that Clint was ready to take this next step. And I mean, first of all, just seeing the talent in that dude when no one knew who he was, like, coming out of that draft.
Oh, I have a story for that. If I can stop you for a second. Like, okay, yeah. I was at the Rockets draft party, right? And, like, this is, if you guys don't know what the Rockets draft party, it's like a whole bunch of season ticket holders that gather. There's a whole bunch of Rockets executives there. They're watching the draft, and they're, you know, there's games going on, there's trivia, there's bowling and stuff like that. It's a fun thing, right? And, like, Clint Capela's name came on the board, and everybody's face, like, if you look around the world, nobody had a clue who the hell he was. Like, nobody. And it got to the point where somebody from the Rockets, like, had to grab the mic and ensure the fans. Like, he literally said, guys, don't worry, Daryl Morey knows what he's doing, right? Because there was some groaning going on during that party. Like, what the hell is Daryl doing? Like, who is this guy from Switzerland or whatever, right? Like, nobody knew who he was, and people were Googling him at the party. Right? and just the irony, like, everybody know, like, everybody at that party is, like, probably so thankful that they draft, like, I think there was somebody else that they wanted at that position, like the party had this collective person that they wanted, and now, like, I feel like it's a blowout, right? Like, they're so happy that it was Clint. Okay, go ahead. Yeah, George, I cut you off. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. And I just wanted to add it's a point about Capela, but I think it's also just a point about how the Rockets are one of the few NBA teams that actually treat the D League as a developmental league, if that makes any sense. Normally, Morey will draft a guy, and if he's a second round guy or something, and he doesn't immediately stand out and earn a job, he just spends most of the year of his rookie year in the Rio Grande Valley. And next thing you know, he's contributing, like, the following year. And that kind of happened with Capela. And, like, I wouldn't be surprised if, like, next year Kyle Wilcher is just, like, a, a phenomenal rotation player. Like, it kind of speaks to Morey's use of the developmental system too, that I don't think really gets talked about that much.
Yeah, that's a big deal. Instead of wasting young players on the bench, actually finding out if they can play or not. And so, you know, that so many teams just let guys sit on the bench and not play, and they neither impress anybody because they can't play, or when they do play, they don't look good. Well, yeah, send them to the D-League so we can try to reclaim them, or like try to actually get a look at them. I think it actually speaks volumes to how good Morey and the executives in the Rockets are that guys like Wiltshire, you know, the fact that we expect Wiltshire to just come out and like be surprisingly good, that alone is a good sign. But also that you have like all these players that get drafted kind of mid or late first round or in the second round end up contributing. And then the fact that they go other places and don't look as good, that also is weirdly a good sign, I think, for Houston and their management, because it means they know how to maximize players' talents. They know how to make players look better and get them to and make them able to contribute more than they would in just a generic system. So I think it's very impressive that they know how to kind of tease this out of guys. And yeah, this is obviously a place where players can go to have the better years in their career.
And I thought you made a great point there, George. Like, I almost feel like I expect Chinani Onuwaku to like have like a breakout season next year, right? Like I feel like he's gonna be like the backup center next year if Nene chooses to walk.
I'm actually expecting that if Nene chooses to walk or retire or something, fully expect Nanu and his granny shot free throws to come in and just make a difference.
Right, like, and he'll be like the next Clint Capella, making major waves in a Western Conference series, right? Like I feel like people forget like. Clint Capella was making like contributions on a conference finalist, right? Like we saw this early on with Clint. Like that's huge.
As a rook, what even? Right? Yeah, they really get guys up to speed, don't they?
Yeah, and like this was like earlier in the year. Like we thought, like is Clint Capella good? Like I remember, like there was a stretch where Clint Capella didn't make a field goal for like seven games or something like that. Like he didn't make anything, and he couldn't make free throws. Like we thought he was a bum for like a few weeks there, and then he comes out in the biggest stage of his career probably, and like shows up like when the Rockets absolutely need him and switches on to Steph Curry and gets major stops like on the MVP, right? That's the kind of stuff the Rockets do with their Rio Grande Valley system. Like they just find these guys late in the draft and they take gambles on not only like with guys like American born players, like they do this with like Demo, right? Like they drafted Demo, they stashed him. He came over and he was contributing like immediately when Terrence Jones went down, right? And Daryl Morey just does stuff like that. And I feel like Zochi's gonna have a moment like that too, right? Like Zochi's gonna come out in like 3 years and he's gonna like show up in the biggest stage of his life and like the Rocket, and he's gonna make like the game saving stop or something. I don't know. Like you just kind of expect that from him at this point.
Yeah, I mean, the developmental aspect is really interesting, but also just the eye for talent, I think. I mean, think about some of those second round draft picks over the recent years, you know, highlighted with like Chandler Parsons and like Carl Landry and those kind of, well, Carl Landry was probably not a Morey guy. I don't remember, but like those type of talents that just come in and maybe they're like the eighth man in the rotation, but they're just going to come in and contribute.
Yeah, and we didn't even talk about like one of the major signings the Rockets made this season. They signed Nene for the room exception, and that was like Rockets fans immediately knew that was a steal. Like I still can't believe like the Rockets got him for the deal they got him for, like $2.5 million for 1 year on a Nene rental, and like it was just like, and Nene's making huge contributions for this team, right? Like, he's one of the most important players on the roster, even though he's a bench player, right? Like, he's really helping Clint Capella ease into that starting role. He's playing down the stretch in close games, like, and he's making key stops. He's he's still freakishly athletic, so he can still dunk. And like Morey got him for as cheap as you can get him, just because his value dropped in Washington.
And I was, at the time of the signing, I was very surprised at the dollar figure. I knew it was a total steal because I for whatever reason, I watch a lot of the Wizards games. and I was like, I saw Nene playing well. And I was like, oh, wait, we got him for $3 million? Like, that's insane. And then, of course, he comes into camp just totally shredded. So I was like, oh, yeah, total steal. he's gonna be awesome. And so far, he has been.
He's like some kind of basketball wizard out there. It's amazing. He has the most early gray beard I've ever seen. Like, I always think he's got to be like 43, but he's like 35 or something. It's weird how gray he is.
Yeah, yeah, and he still has a lot of bounce. And I feel like just off this season alone, like Nene's gonna get a pretty good contract from a team next summer, and that's because the Rockets restored his value, and they did that with pretty much everybody they signed. Like they found broken free agents, right? And I use the term broken like very specifically because they're at the lowest point of their careers, and they gave them good deals, and they're really contributing to championship roster teams, In any other situation, I don't think Ryan Anderson and Eric Gordon would be having the seasons they're having. But in this situation, under Mike D'Antoni, which also highlights how good Mike D'Antoni the signing was for them, because he utilized these guys in the best ways and he restored their value, like that you couldn't find a better situation for these guys.
Yeah, they're always reclaiming players. I mean, they even made like Omri Caspi look good for a few months a couple years ago. So. I mean, look at what happened to Aaron Brooks after he left. When Aaron Brooks is in Houston, he just looked like this amazing prodigy point guard out of nowhere. Then he moves on elsewhere, and for every year after he left the Rockets, he just has not been the same. It's amazing how they maximize guys' potential.
Oh, and like to me, the maybe the best case of like maximizing potential for a guy was like Chuck Hayes. Guy's 6'6". Playing center, and he got a triple double in a game. Like, how insane is this?
Yeah, like I love Chuck Hayes, man. Like,
yeah, I love the Chuck Wagon.
Yeah, and like he was contributing to like a borderline playoff team for like how many years? Like 3 or 4 years when the Rockets were like fighting to make the playoffs, and like he was playing pretty good defense. Like, and he held his own down there, and. Yeah, and they just find these guys, man. And I almost feel like Troy Williams. Like, I have no idea who the hell Troy Williams is, but I feel like he's gonna become a player soon. Like, because like I have that much faith in the front office. And I made a joke on Twitter. Like Troy Williams is gonna make the game saving stop on Kevin Durant, right? Like, that's gonna happen this year, right? Like, and he's gonna lead the Rockets to their first NBA Finals because that's just what happens with Troy, right?
Like, I'll take it.
Go ahead.
No, I was gonna say that scenario is like exactly what happened with Troy Daniels, except it was a game winning three in the playoffs.
Exactly. Like, they found a 10-day guy and he made like. The most crucial shot in that series, like other than Damian Lillard obviously winning the series, he made the second biggest shot in that series and saved the Rockets' ass from elimination, right? And that was the Rockets just find these guys, man. Like, and I have nothing else to say other than they just find these guys, I just feel like that's. All of this that we're talking about, like restoring these guys' values, is probably Daryl Morey's biggest case for Executive of the Year. Like, because he just finds guys like where they're borderline going to become useless in the NBA and makes them so useful that like the people are talking about how the Rockets have so much help. So that delegitimizes his MVP candidacy. Like, nobody was talking about this when Ryan Anderson and Eric Gordon resigned. Like these guys aren't like these guys weren't some highly sought after guys that, you know, like they hurt Harden's MVP candidacy. And now that they've had such great seasons, they feel like no brainers.
Well, let me say what's my low key case for Daryl Morey as being one of the best executives in the league and should win Executive of the Year at some point in the near future. Chandler Parsons at every point. First off, they locate this guy in the draft, and he was so much better than anybody thought he could have been on the most team-friendly contract.
Yeah, he straight up stole Marcus Morris's job as the starting small forward for that team. And Marcus Morris was like gonna be Carmelo for us or something like that. Like,
and he played so well in Houston that he made, that was his career. His career was that he played really, really well in Houston and that he got paid a lot for the rest of it. And here's the most important thing, Daryl Morey didn't pay him. Daryl Morey said it's better to be the one who drafts him than the one who signs him. And everyone was like, okay, Daryl, sour grapes. And now look where we are. He has maybe the worst contract in the NBA. And at one point, he was probably the best.
Yeah, and he's on his second max deal, if I'm not mistaken. Like,
and
yeah, after his huge payout in Dallas and his huge payout in Memphis.
Yeah,
and I feel so bad for him. Like, he's having a miserable year in Memphis.
It's depressing.
Yeah.
I'd feel worse for him if you weren't making millions and millions of dollars, a lot of money.
No, but yeah, you're right. Like I think Chandler Parsons was making like $300K a year at some point. Like, I feel like that was a thing, right, on his rookie year deal. And like,
it was like $900K. You can't make $300K a year.
Yeah, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, it was ridiculously low. Like, he wasn't a millionaire for the longest time, and the Rockets made him millionaires basically by letting him go to a Dallas Mavericks team that was struggling to find talent on the low end, right? And that's basically what they do. Like, they find these guys in the draft. And like Sam Decker earlier this year, right? Like, Sam Decker, I hated the Sam Decker pick, like, when that happened. Like, I wanted the Rockets to draft a point guard. Like, and he ended up like contributing really well in the beginning of the season. Like, granted, he's tailed off so far, but I still think Sam Decker can be a player in the NBA, and the Rockets drafted him a lot higher than any other team would have drafted him.
Yeah, and speaking of Sam, he's locked up as a Rocket on a rookie scale deal until 2019. So so that's part, and that's one thing Morey did this offseason. He picked up that option, and he also actually picked up Capella's option, which no one, I mean, it's kind of a low key move, but he picked up Capella's option, meaning that.
Oh, I noticed it. I noticed it. Yeah, I'm the biggest Clint Capella fan, like, out there, and I was psyched when that happened. But yeah, go ahead.
So when Capella's making his Defensive Player of the Year case in 2018, he'll be making $2.3 million. It's phenomenal. Phenomenal.
I gotta say about Sam Decker, I kind of wish that he would have just not played those 6 minutes in his first year. those 6 minutes, man. They kicked him out of Rookie of the Year contention this season.
Yeah, they really did. But I mean, I honestly don't think he'd be winning it anyways this year. He's tailed off pretty bad. Like that rookie wall, like Sam Decker didn't hit that rookie wall. That rookie wall hit him, man. Like that.
Yeah.
And that was wild too. He was really good up until suddenly he wasn't.
I was making a case on other podcasts that he should have been like next year we're talking about Sam Decker as a starter. Like that's how good he was for a stretch. Like I thought he would become like the starter by next year. And I think he'll bounce back, but whatever. Yeah. So let's get back to Daryl Morey. But yeah, so this trade deadline, the Rockets, like, we kept on talking about how they needed another point guard, another wing, and perhaps another big, right? Daryl Morey goes out, and like, I didn't even think they had the assets for Lou Williams. They trade a first round pick for Lou Williams, and they dump Corey Brewer's salary. So, and we thought like Corey Brewer would take at least like a first round pick by itself, and they got a player back, and they only gave up a first round pick. Like, that was such a good trade.
Yeah, the most amazing thing about that trade is not just that it was a fantastic trade for Houston, but it wasn't really that bad for Los Angeles either.
No, it was
like
a good
they
deal.
Got things they needed. They got a draft pick, and they let him go so he can be more useful. And then Corey Brewer is, you know, his contract's not really going to matter to them. And he can just kind of, I guess, be like a stabilizing influence back there. So that's pretty good. I think that's a big difference between Ainge and Morey, in that, as I've done before, Ainge always wants to like brutally win every deal. But Morey is a little more subtle about it. And he actually doesn't want to just totally swindle everybody, like, to the point where they hate him.
Yeah.
Possibly because they hate him because he swindled them.
Yeah, but it's also funny. I just imagine like an executive getting a call from Daryl Morey, and Morey, you know, he proposes some trade that looks weird on paper. So the executive like mutes his phone and he starts getting all of his like assistants and stuff. Okay, look up the cap. What are the rules? he's doing something to us. We don't know what, but he's doing something to us.
How is this going to screw us?
Yeah.
Like, I remember like when that trade happened for Lou Williams, like I remember like when Magic Johnson got hired, right? Like I tweeted out that morning, Corey Brewer's getting traded to the Lakers. Like, that's happening. Like, and it happened because, like, Daryl Morey, I mean, like, I don't want to say he took advantage of a Magic Johnson, but, like he was
opportunity,
right? He saw an opportunity. He saw that opportunity. And, like, you made a great point there, Forrest. Like, you never know you're getting swindled by Daryl Morey until, like, 3 years down the line, right? Like right now, like, the trade looks good, right? Like Daryl Morey traded you a pretty good player, but, it looks good, right? But what you're going to find out in 2 years, the asset you gave back to get him is going to turn out to be, like, a star in, like, 2 years. Right, like that's just like how it works. Like the Kyle Lowry trade, right? Like I felt like it was something similar to that. Like the Rockets, like nobody knew Kyle Lowry was that good, right? The Rockets made him that good. Like he came to Houston and he became that good.
And then they flipped him.
Yeah,
I mean, like I bet that the Raptors wish they'd had some of those resources hanging around. They probably could have done with a James Harden. But oh well.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that, you know, who definitely is feeling the effects of being swindled by Morey is the Oklahoma City Thunder, but I didn't.
Oh my God.
I didn't need to bring that up, but it's just low hanging fruit.
That oh, one's man. Just a given.
I mean, like Daryl Morey made the trade of the decade. Like, and we're gonna be talking about that trade for like years and years. And we are. I mean, it's been like 4 years since it's happened, and we keep on talking about it every single podcast, every single time we watch the Rockets and Warriors play. Not the Rockets and Warriors. The Rockets and the Thunder play each other. That trade always comes up, no matter what. Like, there's gonna be books written on it. There's gonna be 30 for 30s on it. Like, I wanna read the book on like Daryl Morey's side of it, because like that summer, like Daryl Morey lost his mind. Like he traded like almost the entire roster. Like he traded like I remember he gave away Chase Buttinger to like for like a first round pick in a draft that wasn't that good, and everybody's like, what the hell is this guy doing, right? And like he made like, if you look at his transaction history for that summer, like everybody thought, like you'll think that he's a freaking psychopath, like. And
he got poison pill deals for Oshik and Lynn. It was just such a weird summer.
Yeah. And like
then right when it was going to end, right when it was season, like the shoe finally fell.
Yeah. And up until that point, Daryl Morey was getting killed, like on the radio, on blogs, everywhere. Like people were calling for his head on a stick. Like up until Daryl Morey made that move, right? Up until the James Harden trade, people were roasting Daryl Morey, and then after that, I mean, like this town loves Daryl Morey, right? Like they'll take bullets for Daryl Morey, and it's pretty funny how that whole dynamic shifted. Like the Rockets were in trade discussions for Carmelo Anthony, Dwight Howard, Andrew Bynum, Andre Drummond. Like, if you look at the names they were in talks for that summer, like, it's pretty insane how quickly all that unraveled. Like, they were in talks for pretty much every superstar that was on the market, and they ended up getting probably the best superstar out of all of them. And it wasn't apparently obvious that they did.
Yeah, that's true. That was a time when we still thought that Andrew Bynum was, like, would be a player close to the level of Dwight Howard, who we thought was an MVP. So
yeah, we thought Dwight Howard and Nene and like we thought these, like Pau Gasol, like we thought these guys were going to be the saviors, right? Because the Rockets were in this like peril of mediocrity, right? And what really happened, and like in retrospect, it's pretty crazy how you can shine a light on what Daryl was doing back there. Like he was like, He just kept on flipping and flipping and flipping, like making these 75 cents for dollar trades, right? And the reason I use that metaphor, right? Like if you give up 75 cents for somebody who really needs chains, right, and he'll give you a dollar back, like that, for the time being, like that's fine, right? That's a good deal, right? Because he really needs the quarters right now, and you're benefiting by that quarter, right? By that extra quarter you're getting, and in in reality, like, that guy is, he keeps on flipping that dollar till he gets, like, you know, the prize, which is James Harden, right? He just kept on flipping and flipping and flipping these assets, and it led to this massive trade that we're going to be talking about forever. And I feel like that should, the James Harden trade should be part of this executive of the year conversation, right? Because if James Harden wins MVP, who traded for James Harden, right? And, like, who had the foresight to make that trade and, like, gamble on him? Like, I remember at the press conference, he Daryl Morey said something along the lines, like, this is going to be our cornerstone, right? And people were laughing at him. Like a lot of people were so skeptical about that trade. I think even Charles Barkley killed him for it on TNT or something like that. Like,
naturally.
Yeah, and, like, now people are kissing his for that trade, and that's just the way it works. Daryl Morey's moves always look so much better in retrospect, and I feel like that trade, particularly, like, that should be a part of this executive year conversation, because as George was talking about earlier, like, these awards aren't handed out for yearly basis; they're handed out over a collection of years.
Yeah, and there's actually a very recent case, the 2015 Warriors. Bob Myers got it, but you get rewarded for past performance just as much as you do for, like, current performance as executive. That Warriors core was already set.
Yeah,
they were totally set. So
they only added like Sean Livingston and Leandro Barbosa, if I can remember correctly. Go ahead.
That's all they did, and they extended Clay's contract and Harrison Barnes. But the core was already there, so it's clearly not an award about just, you know, roster moves and stuff, which if we're throwing in roster moves, I don't think anybody compares to Morey except for maybe Dennis Lindsay in Utah right now. But
yeah, and I'm glad you brought up Bob Myers, because he had the foresight to hire Steve Kerr, right? And a lot of people were skeptical about Steve Kerr being a good coach in the NBA, right? And he ended up being, like, Steve Kerr is probably one of the five best coaches in the NBA right now. And, like, he was a big catalyst for that, for the shifting in the Warriors, like, for the surge in how good they became, because they were horrendous on offense. And people would forget that. Like, the Warriors were not a great offensive team up until Steve Kerr got there, right? Like, they were running a lot of isolation plays for, like, Harrison Barnes, right? And in retrospect, that was a really, really dumb idea, right? By Mark Jackson, right? And, like, that's kind of what Mike D'Antoni is for the Houston, right? Like getting Mike D'Antoni is a huge reason they're going to be 15 games better at the end of the year.
Yeah. What I want to know, the biggest Daryl Morey question I have, did he have some knowledge that James Harden was going to come available?
Oh, we didn't even talk about this. Hold on. If I can cut you off for a second. James Harden's extension. Like,
oh yeah,
oh my, yeah, that was huge, that,
game changer.
James Harden's extension is probably, like, the biggest reason he should win this award, because, like, James Harden, like we didn't see this extension coming. Like, even the cap nerds didn't see this coming. Nobody thought of course it was possible that they could have renegotiated and extended, but nobody thought that would happen at this point. It'd take a lot of convincing to make James Harden sign that deal. And he signed it at just the right time, and they locked him up for the rest of his prime years.
Yeah, he'll be a Rocket until he's 30. So that's, he's guaranteeing his best years to be in Houston, and that gives us the best shot at winning a title. So just an insanely, insanely game-changing move. Just a huge move. Probably one of the biggest of Morey's career, aside from the Harden trade.
And he also did it like a week before they did it in Oklahoma City. So he got to be the guy that got all the credit for thinking of that.
Yeah.
Okay, so what were you talking about, Forrest? Sorry to cut you off.
Oh, yeah. Did he, like, have some knowledge that the Harden trade was going to happen? Like, do we know if he could, like, because, you know, obviously at least he was being very opportunistic and he managed to jump on this situation, but, like, did he perhaps know that this is happening earlier? Because we don't know what front offices know. There's a whole lot of stuff going on that we never are privy to, that, like, no one's ever privy to. So I'm kind of curious as to, like, how good his, like, feelers are, because, well, you know,
like from my recollection, like James Harden was in a contract situation, contract dispute with the Oklahoma City Thunder, right? And that was kind of the reason his name got on the market, because you know Oklahoma City wanted to extend Harden not that summer, he would have been locked up the next year, but they wanted to extend him even further than that. So your standard rookie year extension, and James Harden wanted the max. And I think, I'm guessing Daryl Morey caught wind of that and made the phone call. And it's funny you mentioned this, because I remember Daryl Morey was like on Zach Lowe's podcast like a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about how he made the trade like at his kid's soccer game. Like he was in the car, like in the parking lot. Oh, yeah. He was in the car of his parking lot of this parking lot of his kid's soccer game, and he was executing a trade, the biggest trade of his career, in that parking lot. I just think it's funny.
Hey, life comes at you fast. You gotta be ready to open that door.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. To answer your question, I think it's because they were in that they're in contract disputes. There were other teams that were interested in James Harden. I think the Mavericks were you know poking around to see if they could get him, and the Rockets just had the most assets. So yeah, I think we've made his case. I think we've thoroughly made the best case for Daryl Morey. I mean, you guys have anything else to add to that?
I think he made his case. He's been 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, just all the moves we talked about, and then I mean, it goes without saying, winning matters for this award. And if I mean a 15 game improvement, that's just bananas. So, yeah, I think we made it. I do want to point out something though. The whole idea behind this, the case for Daryl Morey as an article, and there's going to be more to come on Red Nation Hoops for the other awards. There's an interesting stat, little fun fact, that only once in history has a team won all four of the awards that we're going to talk about: Executive of the Year, Coach of the Year, Sixth Man of the Year, and MVP. And that was the 95-96 Chicago Bulls with Jordan MVP, Tony Kukoc, Sixth Man of the Year, Jerry Krause, Executive of the Year, and Phil Jackson, Coach of the Year. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating. The Rockets have like a 5% chance to make history, and that's pretty big.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the Rockets will complete the sweep like that, but just the fact that we can seriously talk about it is pretty amazing.
I mean,
considering what happened last year.
I mean, hey, I mean, they're in the conversation for all these top awards, right? They're at the top of these conversations. It's not like Isaiah Thomas in the MVP race, like, right? They have a strong candidate in every single one of these awards, right? Like Eric Gordon's at the top of the Sixth Man of the Year award ballot, right? Like
absolutely,
James Harden's at the top of the MVP ballot.
Yep.
And we made the case why Daryl Morey should be at the top of the Executive of the Year ballot. And yeah, I mean, like there's. It's not. We're not just blowing smoke off Daryl Morey's ass. Like this is a thing that could happen. Like there's a 5% chance this thing could happen, and it's pretty great. Now, now that we're done with the basketball portion of this podcast, I have some beef with you, George, because
okay.
So like you mentioned, like we were texting back and forth about this columns thing, and I don't know how this came up, but I was talking about how I'm so excited for this new Fast and Furious movie. Right, comes out April 14th.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And I'm pumped for this. I've rewatched the series like a bunch of times. I'm excited to watch this movie, right? And you are like, you made one of the most hater remarks possible. Like I think you said the series is underrated or something like that.
Overrated.
Like yeah. That's just, I need you to explain yourself right there.
Well, I mean, there's what? There's about to be an eighth Fast movie.
Yes, unfortunately, only eight of them.
Okay. Out of eight movies, there's like 2.5 good ones. So that's just kind of my thing.
That's just whack. Like the first Fast and Furious was great. Too Fast, Too Furious was great.
Too Furious was funny. I wouldn't say it's great, but it's got moments.
It was pretty great. I mean, we saw the debut of Tyrese Gibson, so that automatically makes it an all-timer for me. And Tokyo Drift, that was pretty good. Tokyo Drift is kind of the weakest of the series. I'll admit
it's like the to shift things, to make a comparison to like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it's the Incredible Hulk of that series, where like nobody really wants to acknowledge it, but it is canon technically.
Man, you guys, I don't know what's wrong with you guys. Tokyo Drift was great. It was Too Fast, Too Furious. That was the worst of a lot of them. That one was just like a rip off of Bad Boys 2, basically.
I think
by far the weakest. I think 2 and 4 are the weakest, and then 1 is not like the other movies. The first one is just kind of a regular movie. It's just Point Break with cars. But it's really when Justin Lin came on board, when Lin Sanity started, 3 and especially 5 and 6. 5 and 6 are masterworks.
So,
they are perfect.
God, I love five and six. Okay. I'm gonna interrupt you. I want to interrupt you about this Tokyo Drift thing. Tokyo Drift was a fun movie. It's kind of irrelevant from the rest of the series. But if you just want to go watch a fun movie, like with your kids or something, like that's a fun movie. And that's all I have to say about it.
It's not irrelevant at all. It established so many of the tropes and so much of the formula for the later movies. It's also a sports movie. You don't see a lot of sports movies anymore. I think that one's underrated. Anyway, go on.
Okay, George, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think the main reason why I had to voice my concerns about it being overrated is just people are treating it like it's John Wick, you know?
It's better than John Wick.
It's good. No, how dare you?
If you look at the pure box office numbers this movie puts out, I mean, it's pretty massive. Every single time this thing breaks a record, and there's a reason for that. It's because it's really freaking good. We love Vin Diesel. We love Dominic Toretto.
We know what the reason for the box office is. Dwayne The Rock Johnson. This franchise dies if he doesn't join it.
Absolutely not. It was still doing fine. I mean, he helped for sure, but I think what people really want to see is they want to see the world's leading melodrama series of movies. These are melodramas, first and foremost. There are cars and action involved, but we want to see Dominic Toretto and his people he's taken on as his family establish how important family is to them. We want to see the life and times of these people. We want to know where they end up and how they fight for each other. It's beautiful. It's a soap opera with cars, and I think it's progressively more insane. There's been nothing like it ever.
And there's this criticism about how absurd this movie is. I don't care, man. Like if you're watching these movies, like, you have to suspend your disbelief. Like, you just have to. Like obviously, yes, a car cannot go through 3 buildings and survive, right? And the people inside it cannot still be there. We know that. Like, we know that. But, like, that's the whole point of action movies. Like, you have to pretend like this thing's gonna happen. Like,
it's not a bug; it's a feature.
Yeah, like to me, it gets me pumped up when they do some absurd stuff. Like when Dominic Toretto like punches the concrete and the concrete breaks in half. Like, I love that.
He survived a parking garage falling on him.
He jumped across a chasm to grab a lady out of midair, across like a freeway while a tank was falling off of. Everything about 5 and 6 is perfect. Everything about his movies is perfect. Family comes first. The street always wins. I will brook no dissension about this.
And the fact that The Rock can break his cast by just flexing his muscles, like, that's that's the most badass thing ever. I don't want to hear it. Like, it's the most. Go ahead.
That one I actually believe he did, though. I don't think that's
just him. He did a rock bottom at the start of the movie too. I love that.
The fact that he incorporates WWE in every single one of his movies, like, I was watching Fast Five. No, I was watching, I was watching Fast Five, and he brought up Chris Jericho in the middle of the movie, and I didn't even notice the first time, and like I love how he stays true to his roots like that. But whatever, like, oh, I don't know. I just love the absurdity of these movies. Go ahead.
When he did real quick, who remembers the great American classic Walking Tall? The Rock, he definitely rock bottomed some dude in that movie too.
And then in the rundown, he clotheslined like a column, yeah. Like a brick pillar.
Yeah, and I don't know. To me, like, I love the absurdity of these movies. I love, like, Brian O'Connor hanging off a truck on a cliff, like, and still being able to grab onto the roof of a car last minute. Like, I love that. Like, I know it's not realistic, but I don't give a shit. Like, I'm here to watch the movie.
Okay.
Right? Like,
Okay, Solomon, let me ask you real quick. At the end of seven, did you shed a tear?
Oh my God. Man, like, Paul Walker's passing, like, I'm not sure if it hit anybody as hard as it hit me. Because, like, and this might make me a bad person, like 5 minutes after the death, I was like, okay, what happens to the movies now? Like, I'm not sure if it happened to you. Like, I was like, yeah, like, this person's gone, and it's really sad, like, and he was a really great person, but, like, man, like, I want to see my Fast and Furious movies, and Brian O'Connor was such a badass character, and it sucks that he's gone, and, like, the way they sent him off in that final scene was beautiful, right? Like, I feel like that scene is me if the Rockets ever trade Patrick Beverley. Like, where the cards, where the cars divide into different roads. Like, that's me if the Rockets ever decide to trade Patrick Beverley.
This is a beautiful moment. My weird anecdote about Fate of the Furious is that my girlfriend was actually visiting Iceland at the time that they were filming in Iceland, and she actually came across the film set. So, she's interested to see. Yeah, if they the shots that were filmed there. Apparently, only Tyrese was actually out there on location.
I mean, like,
no one else came with.
So it's Tyrese freaking Gibson, man. Like, he's like my favorite actor at all these guys.
She didn't meet anybody. If that's what you're gonna ask.
But did she manage? No, did she manage to see The Rock punching a submarine or whatever is gonna happen?
No, I guess he wasn't there. If he's gonna punch a submarine, it'll be done in post, I guess.
The Rock's gonna do something completely ridiculous, and I'm gonna buy it because it's The Rock. Like it's like if it wasn't The Rock and if it wasn't Vin Diesel, like, I wouldn't buy it. But it's The Rock and it's Vin Diesel, like, and that's why I buy it. Like, there's if not for any other reason, go ahead.
Has a rebrand ever been as unsuccessful as The Rock trying to rebrand as Dwayne Johnson?
No.
Yeah. And I think he's kind of taken that on now. These past, like, 5 or 6 years, like, yeah, I'm The Rock. Like, I think he's kind of, yeah, he tries to advertise himself as Dwayne Johnson, but I think deep down everybody knows, like, you know, he's the if you smell guy, right? Like that's him. Like, and
the most electrifying man in sports entertainment.
Exactly. That's who he is.
I will, yeah, say,
like,
I'm pretty.
Joe Morey is the most electrifying man in the NBA.
Oh, it all comes back together. I love that.
Yeah, and to and to conclude, George, how dare you? And yeah, Daryl Morey should win Executive of the Year, and that's. And we laid out the case, and Fast and Furious, like, you guys should go see the Fate of the Furious. They're not paying me for this. It's because I'm just a massive fan of this movie. April 14th in theaters. Go watch the premiere. It's one of those movies where you have to watch with the crowd, because, like, in theaters, like, they have all these massive one-liners, like with Ludacris and, like, with Tyrese. Like, it's hilarious to watch with the crowd. Like, even the jokes that are funny, like, they're 10 times more funny when you're watching with the crowd. Like, I'm not sure if you guys feel that way, and like the moments of, like, tense, like, when something badass happens, like, and everybody starts clapping, like, it's just so fun to watch in a theater. But yeah, go watch that movie. Go subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And yeah, guys, good night.
Nobody builds 5G like Verizon builds 5G, because we're the engineers who built the most reliable network in America. And the more you do with 5G, the more building it right matters. The more your network matters. The more Verizon engineers going the extra mile matters. It's us pushing us. It's Verizon versus Verizon. 5G built right from America's most reliable network. Most reliable based on rankings from RootMetrics second half 2020 U.S. report of 3 mobile networks. Results may vary. Award is not an endorsement.